Penn Jillette on the Free FM CBS Radio. And that was the Mike Jones Enormous Orchestra playing the theme there. And it's penradio@gmail.com, penradio.com. Sitting here, as always, with the lovely and talented Michael Goudeau. And we have very special guests today because all our guests are very special. We have Banachek and we have Jamie Ian Swiss and Banachek.
No.
We have Banachek and Jamie Ian Swiss.
You got it right the first time.
Two great magicians and great mentalists and two people who have done more for the Penn and Teller show than the other two people alive, certainly.
Thank you.
Banachek was very important in us doing the bullet catch, which is the magic bullets trick. Has been the close of our show the whole time we've been in Vegas, and we would not be doing it, and there's no exaggeration on this at all, if it were not for Banachek, who brought us the technology and the ideas.
Or you would have been doing it, and you would have been dead.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the other possibility. And Jamie, who worked with us on a lot of the bits in the show, but especially the flag burning that we then went on to do on West Wing. So we owe our careers to Banachek.
Well, we like to help the little guys on the way out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're both magicians and mentalists. You're now a mentalist, Jamie?
I am now a mentalist.
Are you Jamie?
I are a mentalist. Exactly.
How did that happen, from a card magician to mentalist?
I know. It's a strange thing, but I'm not the only one, actually. I mean, after being a close-up magician, sleight-of-hand magician most of my life, I think the reason that I and a number of other performers that you know, Eric Mead, Michael Weber, yep, people like that, have become interested in mentalism is because when you do close-up magic, and the simple change of a card, when it's so close to someone, you can really rock their world. You really see their eyes kind of roll up in the back of their head. I've never experienced this close up. At a distance, physical conjuring like that can be very entertaining, but it doesn't quite have that same visceral, internal quality. And with mentalism, you can do that.
Uh-huh.
It's a more intimate kind of magic.
Carrying a deck of cards becomes too much for you. It's like, it's like going from a harmonica player to lead singer.
Yeah, now I carry a pencil.
It's more than that. I think I'm probably one of the only mentalists ever not to come from a magic background. I
mean, really?
Yeah. I mean, everything I did, I started out mentalism.
Certainly one of the only great mentalists. That's, I think, the really interesting thing. No, seriously, because I've always said those who can do sleight of hand and those who can't do mentalism. And I think there's a lot of lousy mentalists
behind your back, you said that a lot.
Yeah, about me.
but actually, I think there's a lot of lousy mentalists because often they don't have the background in conjuring, and I think you're a rare exception who went straight into mentalism and became a great and influential mentalist.
Well,
I think before we go any further on this, we should describe to people what mentalism is.
Sure.
Because many, many people listening on the radio have no idea. It's a kind of magic, but it's a kind of magic that the major effect is that of mind reading. It simulates,
exactly,
mind
simulates
reading.
Simulates mind reading, right. Absolutely.
And many of the mentalists claim that they are mind reading.
Absolutely.
And we're sitting with two of the very rare ones that never, ever even make that line fuzzy.
I think there's a couple of reasons why people that go into mentalism want to claim that it's real, and they don't believe that they can actually do a show telling the audience that it's not.
Because they suck.
Them. Well, you know, I wouldn't quite put it that way. Okay. They don't all suck. That's the problem. You see, I think what it is when they start out, they're not confident enough to actually perform something and tell them it's not genuine and then do it. They're afraid they're going to get caught. And they get so caught up in that, that even when they become very good and very successful, they still rely upon people believing coming into the theater. It's kind of like hypnotism. You know, half the people that are coming in believe they're going to be hypnotized before they get there.
Uh-huh.
Well, there's a certain amount of the audience that comes into a mentalism show believing this guy can really read minds. And often that's what enables the person to pull off the trickery because the people aren't watching quite as close.
Well, it's wacky because when you saw a woman in half or when you change a card with your hand, there is no one who believes that there hasn't been a trick involved, and that those people have been very, very successful.
Well,
Doug Henning
believed he could float.
He did. But he did not believe that he could float in those illusions.
Those illusions were one thing.
He could really float, but it was on. You know, he told Randy that once he got the floating down, Randy would be the first to see it.
Right, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right.
He did.
And Randy and I did this talk a while back.
This is James Randy. We're talking about the
right.
James Randy
at the annual department. Amazing meeting. And Randy and I did a little talk together where we showed some highlights of this sort of debunking skeptical series that had been made in Korea based on his $1 million challenge.
Right.
And one of the issues that was discussed was this yogic flying that transcendental meditation claims it can teach you to fly. And this skeptical guy in India, Premanand.
Premanand.
Right, is quoted as saying, "Well, I believe that the Maharishi Yogi can fly, but I just ask, why does he need 6 helicopters to travel around?"
He just did an Indian accent.
Yeah, he did.
Well, not really, but
well, not really is right.
But and once you get to keep you up to speed, the Randy we're talking about is James Randy,
right.
And you can find out all about
Randy.
This stuff. Well, he corrected
well, right,
me.
Randy, he got...
I had him on the show. Yeah. And he said I haven't been the Amazing Randy in years.
Oh, really?
I'm James Randy.
Really?
I was
yeah.
corrected.
Really? But he'll still tell you not to use the A word.
I know. He will.
Right.
He will. But he no longer means amazing. he's just so sick of being insulted. He just goes, no, please, just stop enough with it.
Right.
But if you go to Randy, R-A-N-D-I, .org, all this information will be backed up on the web. And you were one of the alpha kids.
Actually, yeah. Randy was one of the people. I mean, that's why I started doing what I do now. You know, I mean, I was in South Africa. I was pretty much abandoned when I was 9 with 2 brothers, 1 year and 3 years old, raising by myself. I heard Uri Geller on TV, and all the adults and everybody around me told me that Uri was real. So, of course, as a child, I believed it. I mean, I can remember sitting there with a little pin, safety pin, concentrating on it and believing in my mind that I actually did get it to Ben, just minutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I actually came to the United States with my real father from Australia, who I went to Australia to find him, that family I moved out, didn't work quite well.
But so South Africa, Australia, you're on every villain in a Bruce Willis movie, aren't you?
You know what? Yeah, absolutely. There's a story. I'll get back to that. From England to South Africa was something that actually happened to me, and I thought that Scotland Yard was chasing me when I was a child. But I'll get back to that one in a bit. But so I picked up a book by James Randi. Then it was called The Truth About Uri Geller.
Mm-hmm.
And it opened up a whole world to me. And I was actually angry at the time when I read it because everybody had told me bending metal was real.
Uh-huh.
And this book explained to me that it wasn't. Now, I was a kind of kid in high school, I mean, socially inept because I raised my brothers. You know, I never really had a social life at all.
Which qualified you to become a magician.
Absolutely it did. I had 3 jobs when I was in high school just to finish high school. So as a kid, I mean, in the middle of summer, I'd have a heavy winter coat on. You know, teacher called on me. I'd turn bright red. You know, I remember buying a gallon of milk and it was sour and I couldn't take it back to the store. That's how socially inept I was.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I started bending metal.
We won't take it back for you. You still have it?
No, I don't. I'm sure I can find one, though.
Todd Robbins will drink it.
Absolutely. Yes, he would. So all of a sudden, I started bending silverware, and all the kids in school were stealing silverware, bringing them to me. We went to plastic silverware. I got suspended because they were stealing the silverware, and I became really popular, you know. And so that area, I mean, I found a home. The stage was my home. And thanks to Randy, up to that point, I never had a home.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote Randy and I said, look, if you ever, I kind of got cocky because all of a sudden it was popular. You know, it happens, you know. And I wrote him a letter and said, look, if you ever want a kid to try fool scientists, I'll be happy to do it. And he wrote back, if you're ever in the area, come visit. And I went to visit him. I was very disappointed because he didn't ask to see me do one thing. And I found out later the reason was he wanted to find out about my character, what kind of person I was. He wanted to be able to tell the scientists later on that he never taught me, that
right.
I taught myself. I was self-taught.
Yeah.
And then the opportunity came about in the 1980s. McDonnell Douglas, who built aircraft and that, he believed in all kinds of supernatural phenomena, knew he was about to die, and wanted to find out if there was an afterlife, and kind of went of an indirect way about it. He gave $500,000 to Washington University to study PKMB, psychokinetic metal bending. I guess he figured if there were other supernatural powers, maybe there's an afterlife. And they took out an Associated Press article looking for little kids that could bend metal. I wasn't that little at the time. You know, I was almost 18. I wrote him a letter. I was accepted. And then for 4 years, I went in and I bent metal and convinced
him. 4 years?
It was 180 hours over the 4-year period. We would go in on holidays, vacations, things like that. We didn't receive, well, we did receive money, but it was usually just more for the travel and, you know, just a little small on an error.
So to make it clear here for listeners, you were an undercover psychic, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we went in with 2 hypotheses, really. You know, and I say we because there was another young gentleman.
Right.
After I was accepted, I wrote to the Amazing Randy said, look, they've accepted, they want me to come out. And that's when he told me about another kid called Mike Edwards. And Mike only knew how to bend a key. It was the only thing Mike knew how to do. And so he was kind of panicking, so he called Randy.
And presumably feed himself.
Yes, well, he knew how to do the basic things in life. He was actually a law student, too, so. So he called
Brady.
Oh, he
was a law student, so yes.
Which means he couldn't do anything else.
He called me back.
Exactly. Supposedly psychically, the only thing he could do was bend a key. He had a trick method for it, and that was it. He was an escape artist, so he wasn't a mentalist, you know. And Randy said, you know, there's another kid. He's talked to me, and I said, should I trust him? He said, well, I don't know. I don't know the kid. He said, just play it by ear. Our hypothesis, we had two hypotheses going in. There was a reason we were doing this. We weren't just doing it to make fools out of people at all.
I mean, although that, just to make that clear, that is reason in itself. I mean, that would have been enough reason.
It could be.
For anyone at this table, it would be.
Absolutely.
It just didn't happen to be.
Opportunity to humiliate never fails as motivation.
As a child, that wasn't my motivation.
Okay, sure.
Okay, my motivation then was to do the right thing, you know. And for years...
You had the two hypotheses, I interrupted
Yeah. I mean, for years, the scientists had lamented that the reason there was no evidence of ESP under controlled conditions was simply the fact that they had a lack of funding. They didn't have any money. Well, this was no longer the case, and it was our contention that that wasn't going to be the case. The problem was going to be their pro-biased opinion going in, the fact that they were going to believe in this going into the investigation. So therefore, what they were going to really do is they're going to try to document their own belief system rather than investigate it and find out if it was real. And the other hypothesis we had is that no matter how easy the access was, they wouldn't accept the expert opinion or the help of somebody who could detect that trickery. They would think, oh, I've got a PhD. Hey, I could catch it.
Uh-huh.
Nobody's going to fool me. And so we went in for that 180 hours in 4 years. We were validated as genuine. They believed in us. I mean, I've got videotapes where they say they have people that came in and collaborated with them, and the people agreed with them that everything we did was absolutely genuine and agreed with their results. I mean, I've got that evidence.
And one of my favorite things about this is that Randy instructed you that if at any time they asked you directly if you were doing tricks, you would answer them truthfully, and they never asked.
That's, you know what? The amazing thing is, have they done a background check on Mike Edwards, they would have found out that Mike was an escape artist and he did magic. They never did a background check. I mean, he had newspaper articles from his
hometown. And the fact that he was an escape artist and could do sleight of hand is almost a paranormal event.
Yes, that is true.
And there was anyone that knew you in your high school would have done the same thing.
No,
but if they had done that, they would have found out.
Had they have done that, they wouldn't have found out I was a magician. And the reason being is because I got so cocky at such an early age that I wrote Randy, and Randy said, play it up. There may come a time when you may be able to get into a laboratory. So in case they do a background check on you, play it up that you have these powers. So
but
in my local hometown, I was playing
told,
it up.
But which, you're also told, if you're asked directly... He would say it was a trick.
Not in my local town,
no,
but
of course not,
with the parapsychologist,
sure.
Yeah. And at the very end, when we came out and said it was all an illusion, you know, we did it with Randy at the Time Life building. I mean, we had media from all over the world over there. We came out, Randy presented us as a real thing, and then at the very end, we said, no, it was all a trick. We've been fooling the scientists. You can see the jaws drop. The parapsychologist would not answer their phone for anybody except for Mike and myself. And when I finally got a hold of them, they said, you know, is it true? And I said, unfortunately, it is true. And then they just kept asking question after, well, what about this? What about this? Looking for that one thing that would save face. And, of course, there are some things because you have coincidence and you play
sure.
the odds. And you can't explain those other than saying it's odds. And that doesn't really answer the question
right.
for them. They go, oh, well, maybe it could be genuine. It still leaves an open door for them. But yeah, it was, I mean, we had some fun times. I felt like a criminal at the time, you know, it's very powerful.
You felt like a criminal in a good way?
Well,
because
I mean, we broke in windows, you know, like there was one time late at night in the laboratory when, let me set this up, okay, they were investigating another gentleman, and the gentleman had these aquariums, and there was coffee grounds on the bottom, and there were little cubes in there, and they would be locked, and then they would put a stop-motion camera watching it the entire time. So what I did was I left the window unlocked, and we went out, Mike and myself, and we came back to the laboratory at about 3 in the morning and lifted the window open, and I went inside, and we turned the cameras off, and we picked the locks, and we moved, and we made all kinds of shapes in the coffee grounds. We bent up all the silverware. We just created mayhem there, and then we left. But before we left, we had to clean. We spent more time cleaning my footprint off the table that I put in breaking in than we did actually bending the stuff. So I get back to my room, and I'm sleeping, and I've got about 2 hours sleep now, and then the parapsychologist calls me, and he says, oh, my God, you're not going to believe this. I said, wait, let me stop. You know, he said, I just had a terrible night. I dreamt all night that I was in the laboratory. I dreamt I was bending things. I dreamt things were going crazy. He says, that's exactly what just happened. You're not going to believe this. All this stuff is bent, and the coffee grounds, they've made letters in the coffee grounds. And he says, your dream came true. So he believed that my dream came true. Mm-hmm. You know, and we would create mayhem like that all the time. Now, it's very powerful what we do. You know, people sit there and go, oh, it's all fun and games. But there was a gentleman from England who wanted to document what we were doing as well. And he called Randy, and it was at a big conference. He called Randy. He says, look, I really want to get this on tape. I believe in it, but I want to get it on tape. I want to get it on tape in such a way that you believe that this is genuine. And so Randy told him all the protocol to follow, and he did. He followed the entire protocol. And it was myself, one of the psychics, Mike Edwards, one of the psychics, the kid with Benki, and Masawaki Kyoto from Japan, and a Japanese psychic who could twist spoons, do things like that. So he followed the protocol on camera, and the entire time, nothing happened. At the very end of the day, the moment he turned the camera off, Masawaki Kyoto bent a spoon. This guy lost it. Completely went nuts. He had on the front of his jeans, I swear to God, I'm not lying to you, he called it a demonic. He said, Randy's the devil. I shouldn't have listened to Randy. It's Randy's fault that I did not get that on tape. He went on and on and on about Randy being the devil. I had to spend the night with his producer, Dee Clayton, in her room because he kept calling her all night long, telling her that Randy was the devil, Randy was the devil, Randy was the devil. And it was at that moment that Mike and myself almost went to Randy and said, look, we can't do this. You know, we're hurting people. We just can't do this. And Randy said, you know what? It's going to be less than another month. We're going to come out. We're going to explain everything. But you can see how powerful this is. This really needs to be told, this story.
Wow.
Amazing.
But then the amazing thing is that was in, what year did you come out about this?
What was that, 19? That would have been 1982. Okay. So we would have started 1978 when I got out of...
Didn't it seem to you like that was going to be the end of it? That you'd finally done a full heavy thing and that the whole world was going to go, oh, you're right, there's no psychic.
No, not really. Because even when we came to the end of that, there were other parapsychologists who were involved that weren't part of the money, you know, aspect of it. Mm-hmm. There was a gentleman by the name of Berthold Schwartz who now lives down in Florida. And he kept contacting me, and he kept saying, look, we want you to really come out, and we want to do some experiments with you. And I kept telling him, no, 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 because we were working with, you know, the MAC Lab, the McDonald Laboratory for Psychic Research at Washington University. And there was no reason to get him involved, because it was going to be less than a month when we were going to come out and say it was all fake. But he kept pushing. So finally, I gave in, and I went out there. And he believed in everything. There was one point where he gave me a video camera, and he said, look, you know, he said, I once was with a psychic, and she would take the film, and she would take an image of the sky, and you couldn't see it with the naked eye, but when we developed the film, you could see UFOs on the film. Can you do that? And being young, no matter what somebody said to me, I would always say, yeah, I can do that. So he handed me the camera, and I took a picture of the sky, I took a picture of him, the parking lot. When he had it developed, there's his family pictures. Then you see me being handed the camera. And then when it goes across the sky, all of a sudden you see a big blob in the very center of the film. And in that, you see a woman's torso, nipple, and thigh. You see Jesus Christ. You see a woman giving birth to a baby. You see all these things in this blob. All I had actually done when he handed me the camera was I spat on the front of the camera lens. And being a Freudian psychologist, he saw all of these images in the spit as it was drying.
Uh-huh.
So he believed in almost everything. There was another time he used to have these keys that he would put in a glass jar above a radiator in his living room. At 7 o'clock every time in Pittsburgh, p.m., 7 p.m., I was to concentrate on this jar. And I was to try to make something bend from Pittsburgh, and he was in New Jersey. And, of course, I never did it. But one evening he calls me up. You did it. You did it. You did it. And I said, I did what? He says, you know that jar that sits on the shelf right there? You did it. I said, I got him to bend. Well, you didn't quite hit the jar, but the radiator's leaking, and it's all over the floor. You hit the radiator. Now, this gentleman, speaking about this gentleman, at the very end, and this is the thing, some people are going to believe no matter what. Not everybody, and we'll get into that when we talk about our shows and what we represent in our performances and our responsibility in our performances. But at the very end, this is how this gentleman justified everything. He said, you know what? They say they're lying now. You know, they say they were lying during the experiments. How do we know they're not lying now? How do we know that Randy hasn't paid them off? I mean, he basically wants to believe no matter what.
And this is Conan Doyle insisting that Houdini had paranormal powers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be back. We got Banachek and Jamie Ian Swiss, two mentalists, which is mind readers, but they're honest and say it's all tricks, and Michael Goudeau, and I'm Penn Jillette. Yeah, this is Ben Jo Glenn on CBS Radio, Free FM. It's even Michael Goudon. We're talking mentalism. We have one of the alpha kids. Is that what you were called?
One of the alpha kids back then. In fact, we were going to be cartoons at one time.
Never were you happened. Really?
Yeah, Randy, myself, Mike Edwards, and every week we're going to do a con and teach it to the kids.
So. Oh, that's a great idea. Never went anywhere?
No, I didn't go anywhere.
Anyway, that's Banachek, who was one of the alpha kids, and Jamie Ian Swiss, and they both work as mentalists and as honest mentalists. Mm-hmm. And you were going to talk about how you do a show of all mind reading without anybody thinking you're doing any mind reading.
Yeah, you know, it's there's a lot of debate on that, because when you get up there and you perform, you know, do you convince people you're genuine? Because you're asking for a suspension of disbelief during your performance. But we're not asking for a suspension of disbelief after they leave. And so, therefore, we hold a certain responsibility to our audiences. A lot of mentalists will sit there and say, oh, there's no room for a fake mentalist. And I truly believe there is room for a fake mentalist, because, you know what? It's about entertainment. Those are the people that I feel aren't looking at it as entertainment. They're looking at more as a mystery, and I think you can have both in a performance. They're the same people that usually will sit there and say that, oh, well, you know, in a play during Shakespeare, you're not going to shout out, oh, you know what, I'm not really Macbeth, by the way. Well, of course you wouldn't, because it's in a context of a play. But when you come out and you do these strange things and you appear to have these strange powers, you are the authority to figure on that.
But magic is not a willing suspension of disbelief. Magic is a forced suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, and this is a point that is argued amongst magicians, and I agree with you on that. But many magicians think there is a willing suspension of disbelief.
Well, there's a willing suspension of disbelief in that you say, I'm in this show and I'm going to kind of watch it. And if someone were cutting a woman in half on the street, the way you would act would be different. You'd be excited and applauding.
which we have done, actually, on Chris Angel Mind Freak. So on the street, we do a lot of those.
Right, but it's Chris Angel and there's cameras around.
Yes,
what I'm talking about is if you're watching some of the stuff that you see on stage in a magic show would be considered a crime.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes it's a crime, and that's the
thing. I mean, you could have a lecturer come into a theater and lecture on, X-rays or whatever it is, you know, any type of science. And people go, well, you know, he's an authoritative figure on this. You know, they listen to what he says. And as a performer, as a mentalist, they have no other explanation
exactly
than what
they don't
you're
have
giving
enough
them.
Information.
It's not like a magic show.
Right.
But
I've had arguments, and I won't use the name for a couple of reasons. But I've had arguments with people who have worked mentalism without saying it's fake, worked it as real, and I have had long arguments, and won, and then that person has gone out in order to chump me and show what a fool I am,
really,
has gone out to do their show saying it's fake before and after in order to give me a phone call and say it didn't work. And I get a phone call that said the show went much better.
Well, exactly right. Absolutely. In the tradition of mentalism, there are all these arguments within this world. And in the tradition of mentalism, mentalists always say you can't do mentalism and tell the audience it's fake. It won't work. There's no one's interested in the fake mind reader. And it's simply not true. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely not true. If it was true, my show wouldn't work. Your
show
wouldn't work.
That's like saying nobody's interested in a magician.
Yeah, well, that's exactly
that happens to be true.
Well, that's true. But to me, what's wonderful about it, by doing fake mentalism, if you will, is that this is provocative. I like provocative art in all forms. And if you tell a believer that what you're doing is not possible, but make it convincing. If you tell a skeptic that what you're doing is not possible, but make it convincing, this is provocative to both sides.
Well, I have always said, you know, the reason we did, and on Broadway we did the Bible test.
Right.
We had a quote from the Bible in advance and then picked at random from the audience, and we ended up being right. And that came out of a discussion of the Magic Castle with a person who said, you cannot do any sort of book test or prediction without saying it's real. And the theme of that bit was that it was all fake. But what I find fascinating about that is if I say I have supernatural powers, I can read your mind, then you simply have about three choices. You can assume that I'm insane. You can assume that I'm a liar that's trying to dupe you, or you can believe it.
Right.
And those are your only three choices. There aren't even really very many shades in that. You just believe it or you don't. If I say I can't read your mind, but there's ways that I can fake it, all of a sudden the bit is automatically political. You're automatically talking about propaganda. You're automatically talking about love.
Right.
You're automatically talking about buying a used car. You're automatically talking about every
about
way
buying human interaction that, person, that people
absolutely.
Experience all
yeah,
the time and are interested in.
So
exactly.
instead of just going, we went to see this nut who thought he had
yep.
powers,
right.
or we went to see this evil guy who lied to us, or
we went to see a god who actually had powers,
yeah.
and we stood next to
those
him.
Those are your three choices. You have this whole rainbow.
You create an interest. Yeah. You create an interest by doing that, I think. I mean, you really create an interest. If I sit there and say to you, look, you know, I can't really bend silverware, but I fooled scientists into believing I can bend silverware, and I could do it for you right now and make you believe, and you go, no way. I go, yeah, it's a trick, but you're going to believe in it. No way. And then
right.
I do it. And then afterwards, you're going to try to convince me, if you do it well, that it's real. And I'm still telling you it's not. And that's the fine line that we get into as well. A lot of people say that they're going to be people, especially performers. They'll say there's that group
this
that's going to believe no
defense.
Matter what.
Right.
There's going to be that group that do not believe. And then there's going to be the group in the middle. You know, I really find my responsibility as a performer, because I there's not a lot I can do to the people that are going to believe
exactly.
no matter what. I might be able to change some of their minds, and I have, but not most of them. The group that's not going to believe, I'm fine with that. But that group in the middle, which is a very large group, I have a very large responsibility to that
exactly
group.
Exactly right.
To put
that's
it
exactly
in a context.
It's the bell curve. And mentalists yeah. always use his defense. Well, some people are always going to believe no matter what you say. And that's true. I'll stipulate
absolutely.
That. I won't argue. But to jump from that and say, therefore, I have no responsibility is a ridiculous
leap. I disagree completely with what you're saying about that. I do not think it is your job to do propaganda or convince
no.
or to do anything.
No.
You are
yeah.
not trying to make believers not believe. You're not trying to reinforce non-believers, but you are trying to tell the truth.
But my point
and this
yeah.
is the
as
argument
see,
that I've had.
Right. That's true.
I actually had with David Blaine for a very long time when he just said, well, you know, who am I to convince? And I said, you're not supposed to convince. You're not supposed to do anything, but you aren't supposed to deliberately misrepresent the world
right.
to your fellow human beings.
As you know it.
And it's not that you have a responsibility as a mentalist. You have no responsibility as a mentalist. You have responsibility as a human being.
But what we just said fits with what you're saying.
Well, I know.
What we say fits exactly with what you're
oh,
saying.
Oh, I know. It's just
yeah.
that shift of
yeah.
it's not
right.
your
it's
job
not presenting
convince.
An argument.
It is
right.
our job to leave people in sort of the same state in their belief systems, I think, you know, as a performer, at least mine is. So I'm not on stage to try to change people's belief systems. That's not
no,
why I'm
no,
there.
No, no, no.
But it's my job to leave them in the same state that they came in, except entertained. And they've had a really good time.
Sure, it's exactly like, you know, someone who writes a book. It's not their job to make sure that the themes of that book are instigated and fulfilled or any of that. But they it is their job to make sure that book is as true and honest on every level, whether that be an emotional level of this is what I really feel about interpersonal relationships, or a scientific level, this is what the speed of light is, and that's your job as a human being. And it's really funny that magicians end up with this discussion of what their role is as a magician,
right.
and it's
yeah.
never talked about as a human being.
Right. I
and I mean, in some cases, that seems right. You know, but so you know, I get asked this all the time. You know, I've done many radio interviews.
Right.
And they always ask me to do magic on the radio. And I talked to Jamie about this, and it is possible to do magic on the radio.
Right.
You have whole training tapes of doing magic
right.
on the radio.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't do it with me. Right?
Because right.
all of it's about fooling the host, and anyone listening to the
absolutely.
Show knows that I would lie in a New York minute
exactly.
to make the trip.
So they'll trust me, they'll trust Banachek, they'll
yeah.
trust Godot, but
never.
Nobody is going to believe a word that comes out of your mouth.
No. So, Penn, that fork that you're holding right now, just hold it in your hand.
Flat?
Hold it flat? No, yeah, and what happens?
Oh, my God, it's bending. It's floating.
It's not bending at all.
No, it's floating up off your hand.
It's not doing anything
yet. It's vanished. The fork that I had in my hand
is gone.
Has vanished. It's gone. See,
thank
I wouldn't
you.
Be able to do that.
Jamie, it's in your pocket.
Yes. Oh, look, and it's marked. There it is. The actually same fork.
I was actually on Stern once. What's the news, Robin? And and I was on with, I forgot who, I think it was Chuck.
Is he still on the air?
yeah, he is. Chuck, what's his
name? Jaeger.
No, Chuck Jaeger, yeah. But
Chuck Jones.
He wanted to do a gag with me to show magic. So he said, I have a deck of cards here, and I want Ben to do magic. And this just shows you that I believe I may be pure evil.
Okay.
And he said, I'm going to pick a card. And he said to everybody, and he's kind of winking all around the table, and he kind of shuffles. He does this whole thing and really sold it completely and said, you know, I've picked a card. I've put it over here. There's no way Penn could know what it is. What could it possibly be? Boom, 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 boom. And look at Penn's concentrating. And I mean, everybody was in on it. Everybody. Right. I mean, Kennison's selling it, and Stern's selling it, and Robin's selling it, and just name that card. Oh, it's all impossible. No way it could possibly be. No way I could possibly be. And I said, it's the King of Diamonds. And he turned it over. And, of course, there was no cards there. There was no deck.
Right.
He mimed it and said, oh, my God, it's the King of Diamonds. I went, there's not even a deck there. You're all just lying. So, you know, I was in the situation to have these brilliant people
right.
in front of millions of people be willing to lie
for
to
you.
Show me off to be a great. And I decide it'd be much better to be the fool that says, oh, no, there's no cards there. What are you doing? What are you doing?
And I wonder how many people believe that you're actually lying at that moment.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that, you know, that is, you see that on Law and Order all the time when they say to the witness, so you were lying before and now you're telling the truth.
Right.
Why aren't you lying now? So the argument is perfect about you coming out as the Alpha Kids and saying you're
you
a
know,
fan.
It is, except we can explain how we did most of what
of
we
course,
did.
Of course,
you
yeah.
know, but that becomes a problem, too, because if you teach a scientist one way to bend a key, I have three or four ways to bend a key. You know, I
sure.
feel like often you're setting somebody up to be fooled by somebody else and to think even
and
more
card,
so.
Card sheets call it half smart.
Yeah, even yeah. more genuine. Teach them one thing to fool them with something else. Much better to teach somebody that they can be fooled.
Yes.
And yeah. know that they don't know everything and
well,
say, I don't know.
Well, that's the real problem in teaching really smart people this,
yeah.
is you have to explain to them that while they were learning all of that stuff, there was another guy learning to fix cars. You know, there was another guy learning to build ships in a bottle, and then there was you who was practicing doing this trickery.
It is,
and that they have to learn that while they were doing that, you were learning something else. Yeah. And there really are skills involved.
It's much easier to fool a smart person. Engineers, they have to have an explanation for everything, and if they don't have one, whatever explanation you give them is what they'll
the hard part is convincing the smart person that that's true.
It's yeah. Godot's penny vanish, right? For
that's
kids.
That's right. That's right.
You should explain that.
You paint rubber cement on your hand, a spot of rubber cement on your hand, and a spot on a penny, and let them dry. They become cohesive. And for magicians, you can hold your hand flat with the penny in it, slap it, and the penny is gone. And every magician goes, holy crap, how did you do that? Because they know how you're supposed to do magic tricks. Every kid in the world goes, it's stuck on your other hand. But magicians go,
right.
oh my
right.
god.
Copperfield's going, 10
exactly.
grand, I want to do that in the next special.
Exactly right.
This is Penn Jillette, Michael Godot talking about slapping his penny. We have Banachek and Jamie.
I think that's
and
code.
We're talking about magic and mentalism and skepticism and stuff like that. On CBS Radio. Yeah, this is Penn Jillette on the free FM CBS Radio. And sitting here with Michael Godot, as always, and we have Banachek and Jamie Ian Swiss, two terrific mentalists and skeptics. And we're just talking about the goofy stories of being in the world of mentalism. Because I want to ask you guys this. We did, and I've told this on the air a couple times, so I'll just tell the very briefest of it. But we did a seance for Steven Spielberg, and we got lucky. I mean, unbelievably lucky. We had a big force to do. It was really elaborate, and they grabbed the thing that was supposed to be forced.
I remember this.
Free choice. And do you have any cool stories of times that you had a trick that if you look back on it and someone knew everything about it, was really a psychic event? I don't mean it really was, but I mean you just got so lucky that it was none.
you know what? The thing is, as a performer, every show I throw in four or five things that may or may not hit.
Mm-hmm.
That if they hit, it's an absolute miracle. So it happens so often that I really don't remember any specific.
One, exactly. You tend not to remember them because they're going to happen if you're really doing that. And one of the mindset differences between magic and mentalism is that magicians tend to want everything to be very predictable, very consistent. Mm-hmm. You know exactly what's going to happen. You know how it's going to happen, etc. And one of just happened to notice when they were shuffling is the top card in the pack.
Right,
That's and now they're going to talk about that the rest of your life. You know, when that happens, the toughest thing, again, for a magician is when the mentalist knows when that moment happens, say, well, that's what I do.
Well, when I was a kid, first learning card tricks, you know, and you have someone pick a card and you have a way for them to put it in, then you're going to glimpse it. Many times they would hold it up and I'd see a reflection in their glasses or I see a reflection in the window behind them, or they just pick it up sloppy and you get to see it and I would just go, oh, and try to forget it so I could do the glimpse at the time it was supposed to.
Right. And when you look at con men and psychics and phony psychics, and we know that's a redundancy, and one of the things that really contributed to Steve's training and experience as an alpha kid is that they take advantage of circumstances, mm-hmm. right? You know, right. I mean, Geller's always the first one to say, you know, years ago that when the big Ben stopped working one day or whatever. Oh, I'll take credit for that, you know, whatever. And that thing of taking advantage of a circumstance. And, you know, the magician will tend to say, no, that wasn't the trick I meant. I meant this.
Exactly.
I mean, we have instances where you want to use some specific person for some specific routine, and somebody else says, why don't you do something with that person? And then it fits in perfect. I mean, those kind of coincidences happen all the time. But the great thing as a mentalist is I do tricks with information. I have ways of getting information that people don't know. It's not psychic, but it's a trick. But now that I have this information, I can really hone in, and I know that I've got a whole card in the end. I mean, I'm there, you know. So I can take a chance. I can sit there and say, hey, you know, you met Elvis Presley when you were 5 years old. If it doesn't hit, no big deal, because I can come back with something truly amazing, and they'll forget the Elvis Presley thing. But my God, if they met Elvis Presley, even if they weren't four, if they were five or six, it's a home run.
Yeah.
So I can take that chance. And since I take that chance...
Or you
chance,
had a dog named Elvis when you were 25, which is a multiple of five.
Exactly.
That's pretty much enough.
Which leaves me with any...
That's better than John Edwards does. You know?
This is something I really want to talk to you two about. Tell and I did seances, and we said to everybody that they were absolutely fake. And
that was one of my favorite things you guys did, by the way. I know I don't know why you don't do it anymore.
I'll tell you why.
I love that.
I'm about to tell you. And I would say, you know, everything I say after this point is a lie. And then the next sentence I said was, before we get to the lies, let's do a few things before that. We would do this thing, and people had to sign, you know, to hire us. They had to say they were non-believers. We did not want to convince any believers. We did not want to. There was no alpha kids going on. We wanted to let them know.
Is this different from your stage sales?
Oh, very, very different.
I was talking about your stage.
No, this is different.
We went to people's homes for 12 people doing private seances. Right. And they started to get successful, but we could not do it emotionally.
Yeah.
Because afterwards people would say, I know you have to pretend to be fake.
Right.
But tell me about my sister.
Yeah, no.
Is she, how do you deal with that emotion?
I had the same problem, and I would actually have people crying in my seance because I really, to do a good job, you've got to make them believe in that moment.
Right. You know, so how do you deal with that? How do you feel good about that?
You don't feel good about it. That's the thing. You have to have some sort of moral judgment within yourself to know, you know, this is wrong. You know, a lot of people don't have that.
I spent several years working, maybe 3 years, preparing this, my first phase sort of the mentalism show. And my show is very specifically in the frame of before, during, and after. I'm telling them clearly I can't do it. But it's not just what mentalists call disclaimers. It's really sort of the idea of the show. I try and say those messages in interesting and entertaining and provocative ways. And in a very early iteration of the show, I had a woman come up to me after the show and say, and she was visibly pregnant, and said, so am I going to have a boy or a girl? And I said, you weren't listening. You need to go to a doctor.
Yeah.
You know? And I just, and it was very disturbing. And I went home and said, well, I've been working hard to make the message clear. I'm going to work harder. And even though we accept that there is, as we were speaking before, about this end of the bell curve where some people are going to believe no matter what, still, when you're face to face with it, is troubling.
I'm not talking about the moral position. The moral position that people are going to believe no matter what, I have no trouble with. I'm saying that I couldn't handle it emotionally.
I understand. Yeah. It's troubling.
I would go home after someone said... And ours was as clear as yours. I mean, this is fake. This is a lie. Before and after made it very clear. And they would take us aside and say, you know, I need to know this thing about my little girl. And you go, I was saying it was fake. And they go, yes, I know you're saying that. How do you do
that? I've had that same conversation with people after I do something. And I'll sit there and I'll say, everything I do is an illusion. You know, it's all trickery. I mean, I use verbal, nonverbal, magic, psychology. They're all together mixed to make a show. There is nothing thing that I do that is genuine up here. You know, you see Siegfried and Roy, they make lions, tigers, and pretty women disappear. Well, they've got the better end of the deal. I do tricks with information. You know, if you got somebody like John Edward, you know, and he's on there, you know, he really can't do this stuff either. You know, it's an illusion. It's a trick that he's doing. I don't believe he can do it. And I certainly would not claim that I can do this. It's an illusion. And I'll tell them, I'll give them some examples. I'll say, for instance, if I've got a deck of cards, if somebody's not skeptical, I might put the Queen of Hearts in the middle and fan it out and make it stick out a little more. I know somebody not skeptical is going to think of that Queen of Hearts, going to hone in right on it. But if somebody's skeptical, I might stick a Joker in the middle, fan it out, because I'm one step ahead of that person. I know that that person is going to try to trick me, is going to choose the Joker. That's my job, to know how people are going to think. And therefore, I utilize this to create the illusion that I can read your mind.
Right. And then
I really cannot do that.
When they come to you after the show, after you've said all that and said, I know because of the police and the CIA and everybody else, you have to do
this
all those
things. This is
what I
say after the show to them. A one-on-one with them, really convincing them that I do not have these
powers. This is one of the reasons I have.
Does it work?
You know, usually that type of person that comes to you believes in this anyway and believes people are genuine out there, and there's not going to be a whole lot I can
do. I'm not asking you how... How do you morally justify it? I'm asking you, how do you stop your heart from being broken?
You can't. you know what? But even if they don't come to me, I could sit here and start thinking about all those people out there right now, and my heart could be broken.
Yeah. Oh, there's...
I could do my whole life doing that. Yeah. You know, in my mind, I justify, okay, they belong in this box, you know, and these people belong in this box, and it's not my fault that they believe in that.
You're right.
All I can do is do my job and try to convince people that it's not genuine and that, hey, you know, maybe they need to take a closer look.
But it's one of the reasons I'm more comfortable on stage than close up doing mentalism.
So your answer is really, hey, toughen up. There are kids starving in Africa, too. And you're right. There's a lot of things
we don't.
There's a lot of things that we don't think about that would. There's a lot of pain and
suffering. For me personally, yes. Yeah. Hey, I have got to toughen up. Yeah. You know, yeah, it tugs at my heart. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons I talk, you know, at skeptics groups and skeptics meetings and that. And I'm happy to do it because it does bother me. That is out
and
there.
And then you have, you know, you
but
have,
that's all I can
you have
so
your
much.
Little victories that are just joyous,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
I had a woman come up after the show last night and say, you know, all that, the psychic stuff you were doing, that's all fake and most were fake, but John Edward is real, right? And I said, no. And she went, okay. And it really seemed like she just needed that said.
Yeah.
And once it was said, she was like, okay, I just need to ask him directly because he didn't actually say that sentence. But she, you know, processed the rest
of
the stuff.
Right, she was ready. Okay. She was prepared. So, well, that is satisfying.
You are able to alleviate some of that.
Sometimes. But, you know, when somebody comes up and they've lost a kid in Iraq or something, I mean, that just tugs at you. I mean, you know, I've had two boys in Iraq, you know, and I can't, I mean, I know how hard it was having them over there every day. And you get a phone call, you know, and it's a number that you don't recognize, you know, and your heart pounds. And when you have somebody like that, it's just, it's tough, you know, it just really tugs at you.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing that I just can't. I couldn't handle that at all.
That's like the Sylvia Browns of the world. You know, when they start talking to people about people that have lost their sons, you know, at war or in the towers or something like that, it's like, how can you live with yourself even going in that direction?
Yeah, there's nothing more offensive.
As upset as I was about this, there was still an absolute on-off switch when my mom and dad died. I just didn't understand what grief was before that.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even, I used to be able to watch John Edward and Sylvia Brown is kind of a joke and kind of laugh about it. I can no longer do that.
You know what? I understand that because prior to my boys joining the military and going overseas and going into war, I really was like, oh, okay, they're going to war. You know, no big deal. Boys are going to war. And until your own kids go, there's like a switch that just switches and changes.
I can't imagine that. I don't even want to think about that.
but it's the same thing what you're talking about.
I know. It's amazing.
You know, you really cannot understand what other people are going through until you've been there.
And maybe, you know, maybe the John Edward and the Sylvia Browns and those people have just never really focused on what they're doing, and they think they're helping, which is, I think, the real argument.
I don't think they do.
we got Bandicevi and Jamie and Swiss. We got Michael Goudeau, and this is Ben Gillette on CBS Radio, Free FM. Thanks a lot, gentlemen.